Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June the 13th, 2000. In the fireside room this morning is Bob Ekblad. Today's session number is 2002. The title is The Promise Threatened But Claimed: Oppression, Resistance, and Liberation in Exodus in the USA. Let's listen in.
In the story, you know, although God was hidden in the story, because God hadn't really shown up directly, we discovered together that God's location in the story is down here. Okay, so God is at the bottom, and you know, with the weakest, and God's whole objective, or the whole objective of it seems to be apparent in these two chapters, is saving the babies. So this gives us a clue to the unexpected sovereignty of God. One of the difficulties that many people have today is dealing with the problem of evil. How can such horrible things happen? You know, if we have an all-powerful God, why do so many horrible things happen? And you know, why doesn't God intervene more? And you know, when people in jail, it's very hard for them to identify God is present with them. And you know, many of us, I mean, my parents have gone through crisis. We've gone through crises. Oftentimes a crisis leads us to a crisis of faith as well, where we say, okay, well, where is God? You know, I mean, I'm crying out, and I've tried to be faithful, and you know, God seems to be absent. Well, many of our crises come as a result of our theology. We have an image of God that doesn't, you know, that is a negative image of God, or God is distant and maybe the distant judge who we expect, you know, we'd like God to show up, but God feels distant a lot of the time. But if we look in Exodus, how does God show up? You know, God shows up in very weak, unexpected ways, and in ways that appear that are fairly hidden in a way. I mean, you know, we wouldn't have even known this story. Moses was just one baby out of thousands of babies, right? But in retrospect, people reconstructed this story. You know, in retrospect of the liberation, after the liberation, you know, years after, the people of Israel thought, okay, well, how? Actually, before this starts out, we know that Moses, he was raised by his mother, and then he was adopted by Pharaoh's daughter and brought into the courts of Egypt. Right? So Moses was a person who, although he came from this place, you know, he was brought up here. Okay? So Moses is someone who fits into this category. You know, he's no longer part of the underclass. He's been, he didn't pull himself up by his bootstraps, but he was adopted to a place of privilege. So Moses, because he has experienced privilege, is someone who we have an opportunity and we can identify with in a way. I mean, this Moses as a character is someone who I think we can identify with in a way. At least I can. I mean, I grew up in a place of total privilege, in one of the wealthiest suburbs of Seattle, and, you know, with just every opportunity. And, you know, and many of us and in mainline churches have had similar experiences. Okay, so I'm glad in a way for Moses and his, because he is a character, someone who I can identify with in a way. And it's harder for me to identify with the Israelite slaves who experienced this incredible severe oppression and, you know, this hard work and the field work and the genocide and everything like that. I mean, you know, for me, that is just a foreign world. Okay, so Moses is a person who can show us the way. He can point us a way out from under some of the forces that oppress us and out from the place of the oppressor. What is it that happens to Moses in this story that brings him out from this place of oppressor? Or that brings him, what kind of change do we see in Moses in these verses that we just read?
Even though he's in the Pharaoh's house, he always keeps his Jewish identity.
Okay.
Hebrew identity, I guess they call it.
So in some way, he became conscious of his Israelite identity. And how did that come to make a difference for him?
In the story, he finds an Egyptian beating up on another Israelite. And it seems like kind of drastic reaction, but kills the Egyptian third.
Could we read that again? Verse 11 and 12? Or just verse 11?
One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people.
Okay.
But what are the verbs there that we see that are attached to Moses? What's happening with Moses? One of the things that I believe it's important is to try to read carefully, okay? Because the grammar of the text is all we have to show us, open our eyes in a way to just the dynamics of change.
Well, he went out.
Okay, he went out.
He saw.
What's that?
He grew up.
Okay, he grew up, right. Okay, so Moses grew up, he went out, and he saw. Okay, now, I'd like to focus a little bit on this verb to see, ra'ah in Hebrew. Okay, the verb to see is used many times in the book of Exodus. And there are many times previous to this text that we just read, in the first two chapters of Exodus, where Ra'ah is used, where see is used. Someone was talking yesterday about one of the reasons that there was a change. These savior figures began to act was because they experienced a connection. What is it that? And here Moses is experiencing a connection. Okay, he's seeing. He goes out when he grows up. He goes out from his place of comfort. And he sees. Okay. Seeing is a critical part of the process of liberation for the oppressor. And seeing can be also oppressive. The first time we see the verb see is in the first chapter where Pharaoh is the subject of the verb. He says, look, the Israelites are growing, they're becoming numerous. Okay. And then the next time is chapter 1, verse 16. Okay. Where Moses, or where Pharaoh says, when you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him, and if it is a girl, she shall live. Okay. So this is the oppressive kind of seeing, the identifying, discriminatory seeing, that Pharaoh represents. And he would like the midwives to act on the basis of his discriminatory seeing, and be actor, the agents of genocide. Okay. But there's another seeing that's at work here, and chapter 2, verse 2, shows us the first signs of a new kind of seeing. Can someone read chapter 2, verse 2?
The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw it,
okay, so here we're talking about a seeing, a mother seeing the child. The child was a beautiful baby. Okay, and this leads to, to what?
Well, the action of hiding.
The action of hiding. Okay, this leads to civil disobedience. Mm-hmm. Rather than submitting to the authority and being a good Egyptian. A good servant of Egypt. And turning over the child, sight, leads to compassion and a connectedness. I guess it's fairly normal here because it's a mother with her child. But this is, this verb is not haphazard. Okay, it's here for a purpose. What about chapter 2, verse 4?
Well, his sister stood at a distance to see what would happen.
Okay, so the sister takes a risk. This little sister of Moses goes out to see what's going to happen to the baby who's put in the little basket and is going down the river. Okay, the third occurrence is...
Bob, can I interject something? I've got a Revised Standard Version there, and instead of see, it says to know. what happened to him. And I think that's interesting. That when we see, we know.
Well, that shows that the translator understands that seeing is more than just, you know, just some superficial looking. Okay, it's perceiving, a deeper perception. But these are all the same verbs in Hebrew that we're looking at here. So, what about verse 6? And we have Pharaoh's daughter, right, who sends her maid to bring him the basket. And could someone read verse 6?
When she opened it, she saw the child. He was crying, and she took pity on him. This must be one of the Hebrew's children, she said.
Okay, so there we have a seeing, which leads to a double use of the verb ra'ah, you know, and with Pharaoh's daughter as the subject. And what does that lead to? Once again, compassion and civil disobedience. Okay. So this is these usages of ra'ah, of to see, prepare us to understand what's happening in chapter 2, verse 11, when Moses goes out after having grown up. He went out to his people and he saw their forced labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinfolk. Okay. So this leads to an action. But what is the action that Moses chooses at this point?
Violence.
Okay. So here we have a break in the story. Up to this point, we've seen civil disobedience, but it's been nonviolent. Okay, and now we have an act of disobedience, you know, which is not characteristic so far in the story in terms of the Savior figures. You know, the Savior figures up to this point have been using covert means. Now we see more of a macho, you know, more of a the expected sort of attitude towards the oppressor, and that's to kill. Okay, so what does that mean for Moses? What happens as a result of this?
He has to get out of town, or he'll die. He'll be killed.
Okay. All right. So Moses' seeing leads to exile. Moses' seeing leads to a profound rupture in his life, where suddenly he moves out of the place of privilege. He becomes a criminal. Okay. He commits an act against the state, killing a fellow Egyptian, and he has to flee.
There's an Ephesian that says, when Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses.
Right. Okay. So capital punishment. Moses is on death row, so to speak. Okay, he's got a warrant out for his arrest, and they're after him. They've sent out all the agents, and Moses is now permanently, his life has changed forever. He's having to leave this place and to go to, you know, to an unknown place for him. Could someone read chapter 2, verses 15b to the end of the chapter?
Excuse me, could I just ask some questions?
Yes.
To what extent might Moses have been aware of God's laws? I mean, was his training, having been raised in the Egyptian household, did he know about the rules and laws of the Hebrew people?
Well, there had been no revelation of the Torah. You know, Moses was the one who received the Torah in later on in Exodus, in chapter 20, right? In terms of the chronology of this story.
But there's a place before when it says the midwives feared God. Mm-hmm. You know, earlier in verse 17. So if they knew enough to fear God, did Moses get raised that way too?
Well, is there any sign that Moses, is the text giving us any indicators that Moses had any knowledge of God up to this point?
I really have no way of knowing that, but he was nursed by his birth mother.
Yeah.
And at what age then was he put into the Egyptian household, and what awareness then did he have of it?
We don't know.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting, some of the absences in the scriptures are as important as what is actually present in the scripture. The fact that we're not given any information about Moses' piety or his theological formation, you know, I think may be significant. Mm-hmm. And we're going to get to that a little later.
But he was nurtured by his own mother for a good deal of time, it sounds like.
Right, but we don't really know how religious the family was. We don't know.
Yeah, but I'm not thinking about religious teaching. I'm just thinking about a connection to his mother, which was there and probably is part of what formed this connection to Hebrews that leads to him killing him at that point.
Yeah, that's quite possible. Although the text doesn't really tell us much, you know. So, and we have to be careful to try to stay to the text, and let ourselves be under the discipline of the text. So because I think it's significant. It's significant that the lack of knowledge that we have of Moses tells us a lot. You know, what the text doesn't tell us a lot.
But he did know that killing was not a good thing to do.
Well,
because he looked to the left.
He looked to the right. Okay.
And when he realized he'd be doing this in secret, then he did it. And when he found out that he'd been found out, you know, then he was afraid.
And then he hid the body in the sand. Okay, so this is first degree, premeditated, you know, first degree murder, right? Okay, and it's interesting, the verb hid is also a verb that we've seen already. You know, the Hebrew, the mother, Moses was hid by his mother, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's a contrast in the types of hiding that are happening in this story. Okay, and so now we're brought to a rupture, and this leads to Moses' exile. Could someone read for us verse 15b to the end of the chapter?
But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to their father Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come so soon today?" They said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds, and even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "And where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. She bore a son, and he called his name Gershom. For he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land."
Okay. Now I would like to, the actual scripture for today that we're going to be focusing most on in the last 20 minutes here is Exodus 2:23-3:17. And I'm going to pass out this is something I used for my students up in Vancouver. There's some Hebrew words. I don't want you to be intimidated by those, but they're there for a reason. To show the literary structure of this text, and if you look at some of these words and you look, I have it broken down into a chiastic structure. Chiastic structure is like a structure where a lot of the Hebrew poetry, and Hebrew narrative as well, is set up so that you have in what's called inclusios or inclusions, where you know you have the center of the text is actually where the significant heart of the matter can be found. And everything else revolves around the center and moves towards the center. Do I have enough of those? Okay. So I'd like to invite somebody to read verses 23 to the bottom. And if you want, you can just read it right off this paper so we can all be following.
After a long time, the king of Egypt died. The children of Israel groaned under their slavery, and they cried out. Out of the slavery, their cry for help rose to God. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God looked upon the children of Israel, and God took notice of them.
Stop there for a second. Okay, here we have our first indicator about God and God's presence in this text. You know, Moses is now in exile. He's in a place of, he's a refugee, he's a fugitive. He's in the land, he's in a foreign land. And now we're told that the king of Egypt, who, you know, was pursuing Moses to kill him, died. Okay, and then we're given some indicators about God's place in this picture. Where is God in this story, according to these first verses of verse 23-25?
He's listening and watching.
Okay. Where is God?
He's up.
Okay. So the cosmology of this text, if we were to look at the cosmology, the place of God vis-a-vis the natural world, the creation, whatever,
God is up. Okay?
Now, what about the Israelites? What do we know about them? About their particular spiritual state? Does this tell us anything about?
They're oppressed.
Okay.
Crying out for help.
Okay.
And they're crying to God.
Are they crying to God?
Well, their cries rose up. Their cries for help rose up.
Okay. Now in Hebrew, Hebrew's quite able to say they cried out to God. You know, there are many ways to say that quite directly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, in this text, there's no overt piety mentioned. Okay? Their cries of, they were crying out. But, you know, but we don't know anything about, I mean, this doesn't tell us that these were religious people. And the way that answers the question about, you know, Moses, whether Moses had a religious upbringing. I mean, here we see a people that are completely oppressed to the point where there's no hope, right? And the folks that I work with in Honduras, especially, but also many of the people in the jail who are from Mexico, migrant farm workers, they're very much in this situation. They have an image of God as very far away, as a judge. They assume that since God is all-powerful, that God must be the author of their situation. And many of them feel that they probably deserve it. Or if they don't feel like they deserve it, they just are in a state of confusion. And sometimes that leads to apathy. Sometimes it leads to revolt, okay, real anger against God. Usually it's apathy and just resignation. Okay, well, you know, I'm bad. I'm worthless. People have tend to have very low self-esteem, and this is a problem all over the world. It's last week we talked all about the dominant theology that sort of reigns around the world, which is this theology: a distant God, far away. Whose will is the status quo. And I think I mentioned a Zambian friend of mine who says that, he says, you Westerners, you think that the AIDS epidemic in Africa can be solved through education. He goes, no. There's been so much education. Education is not the problem. Our problem is, it's a theological problem. We see AIDS as the will of God. And so if the AIDS is the will of God, how can you resist God? Okay, they're stuck under the. They're oppressed by a negative image of God. Okay. But many of us are. I grew up with the flip side. I grew up giving thanks to God for our speedboat that could take me water skiing around Lake Washington. You know, and kind of naively giving thanks for the fruits of, you know, of labor, and that was honest labor, but that was fairly ignorant of some of the roots of, you know, of where. You know, just my where I was in the pecking order in terms of the global social, you know, kind of class system, right? You know, I'm on top, and it's not because of anything that I merited. I was born into privilege, right? Okay. So anyway, there's the two sides of that theology of glory, that theology, the dominant theology, you know. But all of us, in a way, are oppressed by it because it demobilizes the poor, but it also demobilizes us. And I grew up being told, hey, the poor, you know, you don't want to help them too much because that creates dependency, you know, and why can't they just pull themselves up by their bootstraps, you know? Okay, so anyway, here we have God as, we're given an indicator now that not only is Moses seeing, and, you know, and the midwives, but we have God who is now the subject of this verb. You know, the backside. Not to look at now, but to look at later. Please, don't look at it now. It's just for your resource, for you guys. I have the kind of all the words of Ra'ah documented for you, so you can get an idea of how you can do a word study and in a fruitful way, okay? But it's critical. This is a critical part of the picture. It's not enough for humans to see. And that's not why, I'm a believer. You know, because I've gone to Central America and gotten blown away by the poverty and by the oppression. That's not why I am attracted to the good news. The reason I'm attracted is because I have gotten a glimpse into the possibility that God sees, and that God not only sees from this distant place, but there's something else. You know, God is at work to act upon God's awareness of oppression. Could someone read for us verses 1 to the end?
When Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, he led his flock behind the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of Yahweh appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He saw, and the bush was blazing, and yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up.
Keep going.
When Yahweh saw that he had turned aside to see, God called him out of the bush, Moses, Moses, and he said, here I am. Then he said, come no closer, remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you were standing is holy ground. He said further, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then Yahweh said, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their suffering. So I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, the land of corn with milk and honey, to the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. The cry of the children of Israel has both come to me. I have also seen how the Egyptians oppress them. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He said, I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God on this mountain. But Moses said to God, if I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your ancestors has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. He said further, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, thus you shall say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my title for all generations. Go and assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have given heed to you and to what has been done to you in Egypt. I declare that I will bring you up out of the misery of Egypt into the land of Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey.
All right. So just briefly, if you look at the A and then the A prompt, you know, the first two categories, you know, the bookend this whole thing, we have first of all, you know, the context of oppression and the cry going up, and we have mentions of, you know, of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and of Egypt, and we have a number of verbs that repeat. Okay, what changes do we have between A and A prompt? What changes? What's different about the first part, the second part from the first part?
Is it the difference that in the first part, God merely looks upon them?
Mm-hmm.
And in the second part, it gives them direction.
Okay. What is the direction? What does God say that's different?
Assemble the elders.
Okay.
And say to them these things. And then, but before, he's simply listening.
Okay.
Taking notice.
And who is God addressing in verse 60?
Moses.
Okay. So we have a human figure, a mediator figure that has entered the picture. Mm-hmm. Okay. In addition, we have this call to go and assemble the elders. And then what's he to say to the elders that's different about what we know about God? From the first section.
The first section, God is sitting there up there,
mm-hmm.
off and away.
Right.
And in the second part, he's bringing them up.
Okay, bringing them up. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, now that's critical. And that's the hiphil form of the verb, the cognitive stem, which means God is the subject of the verb. I will cause them to come up. Mm-hmm. So God is taking responsibility to bring them up out of a situation of oppression. Whereas in the beginning, all we know is that God is seen. You know, and that's a comfort. It's a comfort for people to know that God is aware of oppression, right? But is it enough?
Well, and he also remembers his covenant in the first part, and then in the second part, he reminds them of it.
Okay, right. I declare that I will bring you up out of the misery of Egypt, and then we have this this destination, okay, this place of promise. You know, yesterday we talked about the promise. I will go from, you know, from your father's house and, you know, your land and your ethnicity and everything. Go to a place that I will cause you to see. You know, and I will make you a great nation. You know, the promise of to Abraham, and which is confirmed over and over again to all the patriarchs, the promise of blessing. You know, through your descendant, I will bless all the families of the earth. There's this promise of blessing. Okay. The promise of blessing, we've seen that it was threatened over and over. Okay, it was threatened by all these things for us. You know, threats to the promise and the blessing, distraction of work, negative images of God, the passions, debt, busy, busy, busy. You know, but it was threatened by the Israelites too, by, you know, the field work, the genocide, the forced labor, discrimination. Okay, so here we can see that that the promise is presented as a possibility. But why is it a possibility? The promise is presented here as an eventuality, as something that will be realized. It's
but doesn't it depend on our response?
Well, and that's a good question. And that's something we're going to be looking at a little closer as we move along.
Well, this says that God is going to do it, right?
This here says that God's going to do it. So the question, if we're going to look just at the text, in these two, this A prompt, what we have is, Moses has a role. He's to go and assemble the Israelites. But what's he to tell them? You know, that God has seen, you know, God has, that God has appeared, and that God has heard, and God has, God will bring them up. Okay, so there's no, they're not told that they have any part to play in the picture yet. We're going to get there later on in the week, actually.
It's interesting, too, to note that Moses is at a place in his life at that time, it seems, where he has practically no rights or power or integrity, and he's a refugee from justice.
He's a refugee from justice. Yeah. Let's look at that a little closer. We've seen that Moses has seen. You know, we looked at this verb to see. Okay, but his seeing didn't lead to liberation. What it led to was exile. Okay, having his eyes open to the oppression, you know, led to a complete rupture for him and a moving out of his place of privilege to a place of being a refugee and a fugitive. In an exile. He's a murderer. He's got a warrant out for his arrest. Okay, so what we have here now is another use of the verb see. At least there's another object of the verb, you know, which is critical. There's a second kind of seeing here, or maybe a third kind of seeing. First kind would be the one that led to compassion and resistance. The second, the seeing that led to another kind of resistance, violent resistance. The third now, a seeing that leads to something else. Where does Moses go in this story? In the beginning of the text here. Okay. What was Moses? It says, now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock behind the wilderness, and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. So where is the location of this encounter that Moses has? Okay, it's the wilderness. What do we know about the wilderness in the scriptures? Last week, Michael talked a bit about this, but I'd like to refresh your memories. Does anyone know what sort of things happened in the wilderness previous to this in the book of Genesis? Okay, testing and temptation is something that happens later in the book of Exodus.
Revelations, too. It seems like when they get out into the wilderness where there aren't the distractions that we've been talking about,
okay,
they're able to be still to know and hear the voice of God.
Otherwise, that's right. Okay. You know, in this, if we look chronologically at what we have in Genesis, the previous usages of the wilderness, Midbar, the first place where wilderness is mentioned is the angel of the Lord finds Hagar. The wilderness is a place where people who are excluded are cast. Okay, the people who are the marginalized and the rejected are sent off into the wilderness. First two occurrences in the Bible of wilderness are Hagar found, being cast out into the wilderness, and she's fleeing Sarah. Okay, and the angel of the Lord meets her there. So it isn't a place, it's a place where she's cast, but it's also a place of encounter, where God meets the marginalized person and sends, in this case, sends her back to her mistress. And then, once again, Abram sent Hagar and Ishmael away, after Sarah cast her away a second time, and said in Genesis 21:14 that she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. Okay, and then there, once again, in this place of isolation and exclusion, it says God heard the voice of the child as crying. And the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven, and God opened her eyes to a spring. Okay, so, and then God is described as being with Ishmael, who lived in the wilderness. Ishmael being the rejected one, in contrast to Isaac, who was the embraced one. The next occurrence is Joseph. Joseph is cast into the pit. And Reuben said, shed no blood, cast him into this pit here in the wilderness. Okay. So once again, in a consistent way, the wilderness is a place of for the marginalized, for the people who are persecuted, excluded, but also the place of salvation, right? Because the Midianites come along and they pull him up out of the pit and they bring him into Egypt, where he serves Potiphar and where he eventually becomes a person of power in Egypt. So the wilderness is a place of exile, where people are casted who are rejected by others. But it's a place where God comes to meet people. Now, in this text, it's the Hebrew is very specific. It says Moses came to the other side of the wilderness. What might that mean? Moses came beyond the wilderness. What might be the deeper meaning of that?
A strange land.
Okay, strange land.
Enlightenment.
What's that?
A little bit of enlightenment.
Well, he hasn't had enlightenment yet, though.
Well, it seems to me if you're coming out of the wilderness, you're getting somewhat enlightened.
But he's not out of it yet. See, he's like at the depths of it, is what the Hebrew refers to. It's like he's back behind it, kind of like he's gone further than the wilderness. The idea of the Hebrew is that this guy has descended into the depths. Okay, he's gone not only to the wilderness, but a step further. It's like in AA they call it bottoming out, that's one way to read this. I think that's not that's in keeping with the text. Moses came to a point of utter desolation. But at that point, what does he come to? The mountain of God. Okay. The mountain of God. So what is Moses doing when God shows up?
He's watching the sheep.
He's not deep in contemplative prayer there at the very bottom of the wilderness. Is he crying out to God? Does it say anything about his piety in this text?
It's working.
So we know nothing about Moses, and the absences here are important. When I ask this question to the guys in the jail in a Bible study, I'll say, well, what was Moses doing? What do we know about Moses? He was a religious person, wasn't he? He was always going to Mass. He went to Mass every day. In fact, he just left Mass, and there he was. And he just made the sign of the cross, and he was on his knees. And he had just read one of the Psalms, and he'd been fasting for 40 days and 40 nights. and he just renounced evil and was weeping tears of repentance. And, he was totally contrite. And he just told God, I'm going to change. I'm never going to be a bad guy again. I'm going to be good. He made all kinds of New Year's resolutions about how he was going to pray every day, pray without ceasing.
By this time, they're laughing, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll say something like, well, and Moses was, he just made the sign of the cross and he'd been deep in contemplative prayer and all the guys would be looking bewildered. I say, your Bibles don't say that. You must have a bad translation. No. He was wandering with the sheep. He was working, you know. Okay, so what might be the equivalent for you guys, you know? One guy says, oh, it's like I'm out in the strawberry patches, you know, picking strawberries or something. In fact, the bush that is used there is like raspberry bush. So it works really good during the raspberry harvest. Okay, so here we have a third kind of seeing. But this seeing, Moses is not the subject of the verb. Here it's the nifal form, which is the passive or reflexive. Moses, God was seen to Moses. Okay, so this second kind of seeing is decisive for Moses. It's not enough for Moses, it's not enough for us to go out and to see the oppression, you know, to have our encounters with the poor. You know, that's important. It's a critical part of the picture of our growing up, going out, seeing, okay, being overwhelmed by that. Okay, but what's critical is somehow that we find ourselves, you know, maybe what's important is that we find ourselves in a place of desolation, or, you know, a place where we're in a place of expectation, because it's God's appearing. It's that new kind of seeing. It's the spiritual vision that changes everything in this story. Now, what does God say to Moses? What are God's first words?
He called his name.
Okay. God appears in a flame of a fire out of a bush. He saw, and the bush was blazing, and it was not consumed. But that's pretty important too, right? Like, this is a God who, if this was an all-powerful God who was totally scary and everything, I mean, the bush would have been just fried to smithereens, right? It would have just been dust and ashes. You know, some people point to this, the fact that the bush was not consumed, as a sign of God's otherness, but on the one hand, but on the other hand, God's gentleness. Okay.
He also says his name twice, and there should be no doubt.
Now, for the rabbis, an old tradition says that if God says your name twice, you've been saved in this life and in the next. Okay, so talk about salvation by grace. And that's an ancient tradition. You know, when God speaks someone's name twice, that's what that means. Okay, so Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. He said, here I am. Okay, so Moses is coming face to face with God. This is what happens at the depths of the wilderness. This is what happens by God's initiative in this story. Okay, so if we go to verse 7, if we look at verse 6 or verse 5, and he said, come no closer, remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He said further, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Now, what does that evoke? Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God.
Humility.
Guilt? Guilt about what?
The murder.
The murder. Okay. Here we have two verbs that evoke the murder. He hid the body in the sand, and he was afraid. So Moses is immediately, I mean, the reader is triggered immediately to back to the murder scene, right? Okay, so Moses is thinking the warrant, you know, the crime. Okay, I'm a bad guy. Now, what does God say at that point? Does God pull out the handcuffs? Indeed, I know their sufferings. Okay. Here we have the term ra'ah, ra'ah, twice, the intensification of the term. I've truly seen. Okay. It's the first time we see that form in this book of Exodus. Okay, so it's like God saying, you've seen, yeah, and I've seen too. You know, I have really seen what you're talking about. Okay. So here, rather than condemning Moses and carrying him back for justice, what does God do?
He identifies
with him. Is there any mention of the murder?
Mm-hmm.
It's
pretty amazing, huh? So God meets this person. And here at this point, you know, Moses is no longer someone that we can identify as easily with, right? Moses at this point is someone that folks in the underclass find as a brother. The people in the jail, you know, when they read the story, and I ask the question, well, what does this, you know, what does this mean for you guys? They say startling things. And I'll try to find some of those things that I have written down. So, you know, Moses got, and rather than just saying, hey, you know, you're a bad person for selling drugs. You know, you're a bad person for, you know, for what you're doing and your resistance to the dominant system. You know, it's like God saying, yeah, I know, minimum wage, it's really rough. It's very hard. Very hard to make a living. Okay. It's like here we have a total solidarity between God and the people. You know, God and Moses. You know, here with this Ra'ah, God identifies back with everyone who resisted. You know, with all of these moments where, you know, where the midwives and Moses' mother and Moses' sister and Pharaoh's daughter, where they all saw and were moved with compassion. You know, and here, this leads God, you know, to say some critical things. And anyway, we're out of time. But I'd like to point out again that the center of this text is God's action. Okay, right in the very heart. I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them out of the land of Egypt. Okay, God is the one that takes initiative. God uses human mediators. God uses human mediators who are the unexpected ones too. A criminal, right? Someone with a criminal record, a felon, someone who's on death row. And that, believe me, is good news to the people that I work with.